You take piss, what? I've got a master's degree. Not many people know that. In bullshit.
This is Jai Hitchcox, and you're listening to the Jai and Woody Show. Welcome back to another episode of the greatest podcast in the history of mankind. I'm joined by the toughest man in sport, Paul Wood, and special guest, ex-Leeds and Bradford legend, current Batley Bulldogs head coach, Matt Disco Diskin. Yeah. How are you, mate?
I'm bad by yourself.
What an entrance. No, I'm going really good. Woody, you're late. Matt, you're both late.
Yeah, the I had a meeting. Some of us have a proper job, I keep telling you week. And unfortunately, I got stuck in traffic, so...
No, fair enough, mate. Right, well... We'll get straight into it. Where did it all begin? Where did it all begin for Disco? It says here Dewsbury.
Dewsbury, not Dewsbury.
No, well, you know, I lived in Batley for a bit, man. Dewsbury. It does say you're 5'11", which is, that's bullshit, isn't it?
I thought I was 6 foot, to be fair, on the Wikipedia, but I'll take that.
Six foot wide now, Disco.
Enjoying retirement, but
Jesus, what are they doing upstairs? See this. This is shit we've got to deal with, mate. Right, 2001, Leeds Rhinos debut. Run us through it. How did it come about going to Leeds? Where did your junior footy start? Sort of feed us the transition.
Yeah, I played at Dewsbury Moor, where my young kid's playing now. So obviously still spend a lot of time down at the club. I think the amateur games, the biggest part of our game, and the pro game and everything else. But you've got to give back, as most pro players do. So I spend a bit of time down there, and that's where it started. Never followed a professional club as a kid. Always followed my old man around, watched the local amateur team, and I absolutely loved it. It was really raw and entertaining, and you know, used to see all aspects of the game, and I just admired everybody that played at that level. I was fortunate enough to be reasonably talented, got picked for your representative times and size and things like that. But towards the end, we're getting signed on at 16-year-old. I was the last one out of my age group at Yorkshire level, all that, to get signed, and started panicking a little bit. Nearly signed at Featherstone with Dave Ward, who was my schoolboys coach.
And you dodged a bullet there, mate.
Dodged a bullet there. Nearly signed for Dewsbury. I can remember going to Dewsbury, Neil Kelly was the coach, and we had a little tour around, and he sold it on. It cost £1.80 for a roast dinner after training, and it nearly had me signed up straight away. But now there were a few clubs came in quite late, and it came down between Bradford and Leeds. And at the time, Bradford were at the top of the game, but they was quite arrogant in how they looked at their youth development. Didn't really put the effort in, and Leeds were coming through. You know, they were looking to rebuild, and they were exceptionally good at the time at the youth level. And you know, as soon as they came in and gave me the ground tour and met the first team players, and they just made a massive impression. And as soon as I did that, I signed up straight away.
Yeah,
Matt, we'll carry on the subject of your Leeds Academy days. We're same age, and I competed against you in the academy. And you know, I think back then the academy system was very, very strong. You know, there was a lot of talent out there. But you was part of, as Jai would say, the dynasty of the Leeds Rhinos and all that talent that came through. And whether we'll see that amount of talent again, I'm not sure. It's like the United class of, what is it, 93 or something. You know, there's such a lot of talent come through. What do you put it down to, that?
An element of luck as well. I think you look at it, you know, they had some great staff there. They had Bob Pickles, Paul Daly, who were doing a lot of scouting of the young juniors, and they had a great infrastructure coming through in the 18 rugby. But to get a group of players and so many to push through and do what they did, it's got to have an element of luck. And the clubs rode that for a lot of years, and you can see where they're at now. They've not put any succession planning in place because they've rode off the back of that, and it's coming to bite them on the bum a little bit now.
Yeah, I sort of said last week, I don't think you'd be able to assemble a team like Leeds Rhinos back then in today's salary cap. I think, you know, that a lot of that had to do with players wanting to be there because Leeds are going to be successful. Like, you are going to be in the mix for a trophy, do you know what I mean? But today, I just really don't think you'd be able to assemble that with players. You get big money signings and all this sort of stuff.
Well, we saw that. With Leeds, there was players there who could 100% have signed for another Super League club and got more money, but decided to stay at Leeds. You know, what was it that kept you guys there for so long? And you know, I know we don't always play for money, you know, there's the enjoyment of it and having the passion for the club, but you know, what kept those players there so long?
One, the players were very close. We all came through a system together, and we understood each other, and we knew that you know, 2003, 4 and 5, we'd only just started on that journey, but we knew how talented we were as a group, and we were all very, very demanding of each other. You know, it was no holds barred in training, to the points where there were sometimes a lot of friction, even though we're good friends, and it created a real demanding and winning environment, which obviously it bared fruition. Gary Everington, you know, is historically, and as everybody knows, he's got his presentation about a pie, and there's a certain element for you and this level and that level and everything else. But we got sold on the dream of winning trophies, and we all bought into that. And I know players could have left for more money. I know from my own experience I could have left on a couple of occasions for double the amount of money I were earning at Leeds. But we were winning trophies, yeah. And you can't buy that when you finish. So I don't think any of the players there would have swapped the money for what we achieved.
How good is that? It just takes me back to my training days, though. Like, when you have that friction on the field, on your training patch, but then you step off the field and then you were so close that you just, your mates again, you know what I mean? Mm. It's a great feeling to have that you can be, you're pretty much fisticuffs in training, but then you come off it and you're just mates and it's forgotten about.
Yeah, it was really demanding. I know from, if I was playing hooker and my pass weren't on the button, the expression I got off, whether it was Danny, Rob or Kev, it was not necessarily words, but a look of disgust because the pass wasn't on the button. And you know, if they didn't deliver, they'd get the same from me. And the players, we were just all very demanding of each other. And training was every session, every, whether it's a gym session, a wrestle session, a field session, was always very intense and, you know, at a level that most other clubs wouldn't be at.
That's sort of like going back to that team. You can have, say, quite a dominant halfback, sign another dominant halfback, and the whole ship just sinks. Do you know what I mean? Mm. But you had so many dominant players in so many key areas that it's sort of miraculous that it flowed so smoothly. Do you know what I mean? It's just, there was leaders in the front row, there was leaders in the back row, you led yourself, there was leaders on both sides of the park, and yet it all flowed smoothly.
The other period though, Leeds, where you were sort of always the bridesmaids and never the bride, and you'd not won a grand final even though all this talent had come through and you certainly had the potential, and then obviously Tony Smith comes into the Leeds Rhinos and sort of takes you over the finish line. What was the, you know, the difference or the catalyst towards you getting that, I suppose, that winning mentality, but having the, I don't know, what would you say? The, I don't know, think
prowess.
Of the guy. Yeah, what got you over that finish line, you know, give you that confidence.
Sure. I'll be honest with you.
The word I was looking for, my mind went blank, but belief, to believe that you could win that grand final, because in 2004 when you won it, I just had a feeling Leeds were going to win it that year, because everything about you, you know, you was the first team to get in a huddle at half time and everybody come off together. There was just a togetherness and a confidence just oozing from that team.
Well, you look, the majority of players that played in that 2004 were homegrown. We'd come through a system, we'd known each other for 4 years. We all joined within a year or two of each other. I signed in 98, Rob and Danny were the year after, Kev the year before, Chev the year, you know, so we were all very tight, and we'd been used to winning for four years. We'd won every academy championship going, and nobody could, without sounding arrogant, nobody could compete with us, and we were very good. That got taken through to first team, and Tony gets a lot of the praise, but Darryl Powell made some big decisions at that time. You know, we broke into first team 2001-2, and they had some very senior players there, and Darryl made the brave decision to move a lot of them on at the end of 2002, I believe it was, and put his faith in those young kids. When Tony came in, he put the finishing touches to what Darryl had done. He, as you know, you work for him, his attention to detail is massive, and you know, he psychologically plays a few games with you as well, but as a young kids, we were ideal for him, because we'd have run through a wall. You know, we were all buying into each other, but we were young kids without our own opinions at that point, and we'd have done anything for him. And you know, bringing that success that we'd had, that winning culture and that work ethic, Tony polished it up and had a lot of success off the back of it.
So what then takes you away from the Leeds Rhinos? Because I was shocked when you signed for Bradford. I thought you would have, you know, done a Jonesy and stayed at Leeds all your career. What takes you away from the Leeds Rhinos?
It's hard to say too much, because I had to sign the form telling me not to. but from my point of view, I'm a very honest, very straight person. I'm very black or white. People like me or they don't. I'm not too bothered about being in between. And those
we lie you. Jeez, we lie you, man.
Yeah, you're all right, mate.
And there was a level of dishonesty at the back end that didn't sit right with me. So if I'd have stayed, which I had the option to. I had the option of a 3-year deal, to which I then rejected and signed a year because of a few things that went on. I couldn't look myself in the mirror if I'd stayed. I felt there was a level of disloyalty there.
I really hate that. I hate hearing about that when you sort of, when you know that someone's busted their ass for a club and it turns a bit bitter, like on both respects, where you just think, you know, it wouldn't be right me staying. But I think that's, I just think it's a bit bullshit. You should be welcome always. You should always feel like this is your home. Do you know what I mean? You should never feel, I don't think any player should ever feel like they have to, or you'd feel obligated, you need to leave. Do you know what I mean? Or it doesn't sit well with you.
I didn't feel like I needed to leave.
Yeah.
I just felt that if I'd have stayed, I wouldn't have been right to myself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been brought up to be able to look yourself in the mirror at the end of the day, whether good, bad or the ugly, and I wouldn't have been able to do that if I'd have stayed.
So something didn't sit right with your values, and that, you know, made you feel uncomfortable if you would have stayed. So then
that's what
then
I mean. Like, I don't think that should happen to a player.
It's a tough one, because at the time the public perception is that I left for more money, etc., etc. I signed for Bradford for 20 grand and less than what I was on at Leeds, so there was no money motivation to go. It was the pure fact that I wasn't comfortable.
And you can't really explain yourself when the media says something, and then everyone comes up with their own views, which is a whole other ball game. But 264 games, 44 tries, a few sneak overs.
Yeah, I think the total yardage was 46 for those.
What was the highlight of your Leeds career? Obviously, you won a fair few trophies, but did you have a particular game or a particular moment?
Yeah, I think 2004 for me was the highs and lows of my career all in 1 year. You know, I had a very good year with Leeds. We won the grand final, managed to get the Irish Sunderland Award, got the Leeds Player of the Year, and then made my Great Britain debut and ruptured every ligament in my knee 18 minutes in. So you get it all in 1 year. But the grand final that year was massive. As Woody says, we were the nearly men for so long, and for us all to get over that line and for us all to do it as a group, as an academy group that come together, were really special.
Is this the one against Saints? Is this
no, it was Bradford 2004.
No. I'm sure you won against Saints as well.
Yeah, we did the three-peat, so I think the first club to do it.
They showed a 20-minute highlight clip between the Big Bash, and they replayed that grand final.
Right,
there he is. Right, so Bradford Bulls 2011, moved there, 86 games, 13 tries. So obviously you told us a little bit how the move came about. You don't have to go into detail of what happened or whatever, but how was it? How did you like Bradford?
I loved it. It was an opportunity for me when I got there. As we talked about before at Leeds, we had all a lot of talented players, but you had a lot of captains in one team as well, and they all bounced off each other. So I know Kevin was a brilliant leader and led by example, but he was supported by 6 or 7 lads that had captained any other Super League club. So when I went to Bradford, the second season, managed to get the captaincy, and that was something I'm very proud of.
Yeah.
You know, to lead a club with such history was one of the proudest moments in my career. When we got to Bradford, didn't quite know what the problems were behind the scenes that came to unfold over the years to come, which did sour it a little bit, but the club itself was fantastic. Always been on the other side and the rivalry, but to get there, it's got some amazing people that I still keep in touch with now, and, you know, always got fond memories of it.
So 2014, this is when everything, well, the financial struggles of Bradford sort of would have been creeping in. Yeah, so run us through what that was like. Did the players have much of an insight into what was going on, or was it just...
The first time was a bit of a shock, and it was pretty interesting. You know, they came in and gave us some advice. The RFL came in about, you know, advising the boys about, you know, look after your finances, change any direct debits and all that kind of stuff, to which James Domino stood up and went, what's a direct debit? Which it's got a bit of a chuckle from the boys. But no, it was scary for some of the boys. I was fortunate. I started investing in my post-game career quite early, so I was fortunate in that respect. But some of the boys, literally, I don't know, we are sportsmen, and there's a perception that we earn good money. It's not bad. It's all right money, but you live to your needs, and a lot of the players were doing so. When they weren't getting paid, there was mortgages bouncing and bills not getting paid, and it was a scary time for some of the lads.
No, I imagine it would be. I think, and then it's obviously happened a few times since then. But anyway, you end up there in 2014. You transitioned straight into coaching at Bradford Bulls. Is that correct?
Or? Yeah. So
this is Wikipedia. So
yeah, it is. Yeah, not everything on that as well. obviously there were two administrations as well. The second one was a bit, little bit more experienced to it. So when the shutters came down, there was every little bit of kit and weights and thing all of a sudden disappeared from the training ground at Tong.
I've heard about this.
So you, I can remember doing an interview for Look North and the boys were walking out with bags of stash and everything. So when we joined, when we actually got back on board and the administrators paid us wages and we got back in, we had to have a kit amnesty. To which all the boys started bringing all the loot back in.
Well, I won't name the name, but there's a player that's still currently there, and I think he took a flat screen TV and he's brought the flat screen TV back. It's still sitting on the wall. So
yeah, there was kit amnesty, so a few of us, few of the boys, yeah, everything went.
Oh, well, mate, at least the treadmill looked good at home. Right, then you move to Batley Bulldogs. So this is currently, I think, I played two games under you. Just two games.
Yeah.
One try.
They were there for 2 weeks and trained zero times.
I was struggling. I was coming back from one of the... I almost gave it in.
If I remember, Jai, you're not a big trainer, are you? You wasn't at Fev. He spent a lot of time at physio, but we used to call him the blanket because he was always on the bed.
I can believe that.
That is actual bullshit.
No, it's not.
He's just made that up.
You always see those players who, you know, out to dodge training. They're either on bed or they spend a lot of time talking to their coach, trying to distract him
from
actually training.
I'll tell you what, I honestly almost gave the game away just before I came there. I had the worst knee injury. I just thought, you know, I'm absolutely done. And then even coming back into it, just transitioning into it, I was just picking up niggles and shit. It was a bad time.
Do you know what though? That Batley ground was the first time I ever played at Batley was my Featherstone debut. And it was snowing, it was a friendly, and it was in February, and it was absolutely, and was going uphill as well. It was just...
You have to go uphill at some stage during the match, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, but it was the first half, and I was thinking, what have I done here? What have I done? Do I really want to do this for another 12 months? Yeah. But you know what? It was a good laugh. I love Featherstone. Jai slags it off, but I loved it.
Those stalwarts that talk about proper rugby, you need to come to Batley in those conditions.
That's it, mate. Yeah, Batley you do. But what made you get into coaching? Did you know you wanted to do it when you was playing, or is it something that just sort of happened, or was you planning for it?
You went directly into it as well. It's not like you had a little break. You went off the field and put some...
Yeah, not directly. I fell out of luck. When I left Leeds and to Bradford, I got a couple of bad injuries. Had a couple of shoulder reconstructions and lost my love of the game a little bit, you know, abused the alcohol and painkillers a bit too much and led to some issues off the field, and I got a little bit disillusioned with the game and where it was going. And towards the end of my career, even though it was a rough time at Bradford, I found my love for it again, mainly because of the people and the quality of individuals at the club had. And, you know, I didn't need to go into coaching for various reasons, but I love the game, absolutely love the game. I had opportunity to work with the academy that was rebuilding. I had an opportunity to develop a culture for those young men and set some high levels for them to achieve, and that reinvigorated me, really. My passion for the game, and for the 2 years I was there, I loved every minute of it.
I speak to a lot of ex-players now and current players. Do you still have that passion for the game? How do you feel the state of rugby league is now? Do you still have that same passion watching it?
Yeah, I do. I'm a little bit disillusioned with the game in the bigger picture of it. I think the politics is killing it. I think the infighting between Super League and RFL and Championship, I think it's going to end up killing the game, if I'm totally honest. But I think when you peel all that back and you look at the rawness of what the game's about, I love every bit of it. You know, I go watch a lot of amateur rugby, I watch a lot of academy rugby. The Championship is a great example of how raw and quality rugby can be when you just take away the politics of it. When you look at rugby solely as what it is, the game, I love it. I love every little bit of it. Yeah. You add the politics and the issues in, and it becomes disillusioning.
Me and Simo were talking about it the other week. We covered the NCL with Rugby AM, and when you strip it back and you go to the raw roots of rugby league, the amateur game, and you've got everybody volunteering and pulling together, that's what rugby league is all about. That's why we call it the family sport. And, you know, it is a bit of a shame at the minute when... You know, I prefer to go down to my old amateur club and watch a game of rugby than I do to sit in the stands and watch the professional game. And what do you feel, it's not as tough when you watch it now? Do you think it's sort of been diluted a bit without the shoulder charge and there seems to be penalty after penalty?
I think saying it's not as tough is the wrong thing, because I think the athletes are tough. They're fitter than what we were. They're fitter, they're stronger, all that kind of stuff. But I think the game has become too sterilised in the sense that it's taken away that rawness to it. So the shoulder charge, everybody, as a fan, you love to see the handbags thrown by the big men. You love to see the shoulder charge. You love to see the contact. You love to see the aggression in the sport. And we're sterilising that at the moment. I understand why, because the RFL and every other governing body for all sports are scared of a case coming against them for a concussion or this or that. I understand the fear of it, but as a spectacle, I think it's worse for it.
I think it is. It's that mentality of where there's blame, there's a claim type of thing, and the rugby league, you know, being sued for something. You know, what one thing, I probably worded it wrong there, because I would never ever call a rugby league player, you know, soft, thinking the game's gone. I think it is just the way that it's being governed at the minute. You know, the players are just as tough as ever, and, you know, the back in, you can go back to, through to the 50s down to now, they're just as tough. The rugby players' mentality will never change. I was soft as shit, yeah. But I'll never question a rugby player's mentality. I just get really, really, I suppose, passionate and frustrated with when I see some of the rule changes that are on. And it's as though we know as rugby players what the spectators want to see. You know, they want to, like you've just said, they want to see the handbags, they want to see the shoulder charges, they want to see the aggression. And I feel like we're taking it out of the game, and it's losing its appeal.
Look, that concussion, the CTE thing, the delayed onset of all types of things going on with the brain, unfortunately, the game will never, ever go back to that. I think it cost the NFL $1 billion. The lawsuit was $1 billion. So if it was anywhere near that, that would sink rugby league.
But there was,
there's
statistics out there now to say that 90% of rugby league players don't have brains. So we're going to be
mate,
sweet.
You're
all right,
mate. You're leading the way in test examples. Right, that completes part one. We'll be back right after this.
As a parent, it's really important that kids have fun, stay fit, and meet new friends. Please come along to the Rugby M Elite Kids Camps this summer, and your child could have two action-packed days of fun, new friends, and rugby skills. Head over now and book your kids on elitekidscoaching.com.
Okay, welcome back to the Giant Woody Show. So we've got Matt Diskin, a Batley coach at the moment. Not that he's going to get sacked. He's not.
Cheers, buddy.
Yeah, I know he had a loss at weekend, but he's not getting sacked, hopefully. They do call me the career killer.
No shit, I wonder why.
But yeah, so how are you finding it so far within your coaching role? Obviously, championship level.
Yeah, it's really challenging, and it is rewarding. You know, when I got into the club, you know, I was on a loser in regarding public perceptions, because I just had the best achievement that I had, you know, making the top four playoffs and playing at Leeds and all that kind of stuff. So I took it at a time when expectations were very, very high. But I've gone into a club it's really well run. You know, they live to the means. They're very, very tight on the budget. But it's a great club to work for. The chairman, Kevin Nicholas, and Paul Harrison, CEO, have been really supportive of me, because as a young coach, taking a job with just 2 years coaching experience is a big gamble for them. And they've certainly helped me through that process. But it is a tough process. It's at that level at the championship, you've got a real mix of, you know, players come falling out of the Super League because they're not perceived as good enough. You've got young, talented kids that have fallen out of academies that are wanting to push on. And you've got a few journeymen in there. And it's a real challenge. The biggest aspect of the championship is, it's, you know, compared to Super League, it's not the quality. The quality's there. It's what's between the ears, you know, the concentration and the ability to repeat what they keep doing varies
juggling
massively.
Juggling full-time work and stuff, a lot of them as well. One thing, obviously I played a couple of games under you, but one thing I did get from that Batley side was there's a real togetherness, whether not just before the game and at training, but even after the game as well. Everyone, like, they really care about each other. Is it tough trying to juggle? Obviously, Batley doesn't have a massive budget. It doesn't have a budget that is Toronto. It doesn't have a budget that's the Lee Centurions and stuff like that. Is it tough to alter your coaching role, I guess, to suit a different angle? Because you're not going to be able to afford the big name players.
Yeah, the first year that I went in there, I was I'd only ever experienced full time, and I was probably a bit too intense for the group at that point, and learnt my lessons very, very quickly. Second year, we did better. You know, the group is, they're getting paid, and it is professional, but it's not It's not their main income.
Yeah.
It's what they'll use to pay for a few holidays or put some savings away. So they're doing it for fun as much as anything else. And for me, I struggled with that balance between, you know, wanting to win and the professional and being really demanding, to that bit where some of them boys are just, they're doing it because they love the game and they want to play. Mm. So you've got to find that balance. And I did struggle with that at the start. But the group we've got, it's really good. You know, they've got some really talented players in there. And you have got to adjust to what those players are. You know, for a long time, I tried to put a round peg in a square hole regarding them getting to play how I believe the game should be played, and
yeah,
and persisted and kept banging away at that. And you do have to make some concessions at certain points to get the best out of the individuals that you do get.
I think that's a mistake that we see with a lot of coaches who come from a full-time professional environment, whether they've worked at Super League level or played at Super League level. And I think you're right in what you say, that you take that intensity and you try and imply it into a part-time environment. It just doesn't work, does it? And we've seen it time and time again. So have you sort of mellowed out now as a coach and sort of see it for what it is? You know, it's a part-time team and you've got to adjust.
Yeah, so everything we did initially, because I'm very detail-oriented, so all my planning, everything's done and it's all there. And like I said, for the first year, it was bang, 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 we've got to do this. We've achieved, and it took a while to adjust, and, you know, took a while for me to understand my players as well, because coming into the group and first you don't really get to know them. And, you know, being a coach isn't all about coaching rugby. Half the time you're a counsellor more than you are a rugby league coach. Mm. It took me 6 to 9 months to get to know them intimately. And once I got to that point, I could tell when they'd had a tough day at work, because you knew by the mannerisms and the things where they were. So you got to learn to balance that. But that did take a while for me to figure out.
Yeah, it's a real juggle in the championship. Just obviously, I started at Featherstone and now I'm at Bradford. But just the difference between, like, we've got full-time players and part-time players, and we actually don't see the part-time players. So, and a lot of these guys make up the starting side in our team. So, you know, we get there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and they get there at like 5:30. Mm. We're having a shower and going home as they arrive, and just seeing how different people are when they've, as you said, when they had a shit day at work or whatever, and then you've got the emotions of actually playing a professional sport. A lot of these people have dreams to excel to Super League and to the top level, and, you know, they might have had a crap day at work and then they've had a loss on the weekend, or, you know what I mean? It's just it's a constant juggle of emotion, seeing it run through the whole team. And I imagine getting that recipe right is really difficult.
I always remember being at Featherstone, though. When I signed at Featherstone, I was actually training the same amount as I was at Warrington. So the
just
amount
jammed
of,
into
the,
that.
Yeah, it was just, everything was just jammed in to...
Yeah.
I was at Featherstone for 3 hours a day, okay, for about 3 hours we'd train, weren't we, roughly, gym and field. But it was the same amount a day. At Warrington, we'd probably do it over a 5-hour period.
Yeah, and you've got physio and lunch and stuff between them. And
but that was one of the downfalls I felt that we had at Featherstone, because we cramped too much training in, and lads were working and basically they're fatigued when it came to the game. And I think that was a major downfall for us in doing that. But I think you're right, you know, the balance is got to be bang on.
It is, it's massive. We start at 6 p.m. and we know, listen, when I first got there, if you were late, you weren't playing and this and that. And you soon realise that, you know, lads have they've ran over, they've got to get a couple more courses of bricks down before they can get off, or they've got to finish cleaning the windows before they'll collect the brass in. And so I soon had to back off and mellow a little bit with all that kind of stuff. But what I've had tried to do is I've tried to keep the gym and everything quite compact and intense in there. The field sessions very, very rarely go over 60 minutes. So I arrive at 6, I want to get them away by... showered and gone by 8:30 at the latest, because, you know, they've got families to spend time with as well. So we don't train weekends. It's Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and play on Sunday, because they get one day with the families on a Saturday, and they don't want to be training with me on a Saturday morning. So I give them that to spend time with them and enjoy the company. The
yeah,
families.
And that's the thing as well. It's when you strip it back, it's a massive commitment from these guys. The players are working all week, then they're giving up time during the week, then they're giving the weekends up. It's a massive sacrifice for the family life. So, you know, there's got to be that balance, a bit of give and take. And I laugh because when I retired from Fev and I went to Leadu in the S&C, I was always on at Neil Duke saying, we're not intense enough. Now, we was a full-time team, but that level of players weren't ready at that particular time for an intense, say, Super League setup. We was playing Championship, we were full-time, but they probably weren't ready for that level of intensity. So I think, you know, it's determined by your group of players how intense you can actually be with them.
I think the intensity bit's misconstrued as well. Everybody thinks it's about how hard you're working on the field in the gym, but, you know, the thing with full-time is you've got the ability to do so much more detailed preparation, and
you've got no excuses as well.
No excuses, but that can be very intense as well with the amount of video you're looking at and analysing and reviewing and thing. As a player, it's a lot of information to take in. And not being rude, majority of rugby players are all the class clowns that were sat at the back of the class or in detention, so their attention spans aren't great. So the intensity of putting that much video into them is it's tough for them at times.
I tell you what, you take piss, what, I've got a master's degree. You know that. Not many people know that.
I've got a PhD, mate.
In bullshit.
And a PhD in life.
University of life.
So just back to Leeds then. What's your current thoughts on the Leeds situation? Obviously, they've been under the hammer a fair bit with how they're performing. How do you think, and what's an honest view? What's your honest view on Leeds?
I think there's, you know, Kevin's in there at the moment and he's getting the fair brunt of it as a director of rugby, and that's his role. He's got to take that, and, you know, some of the decisions probably rightly so, but you look behind him and what's been there previously, there's got to be some accountability by those in charge. There's been, what's happening isn't happened over a few months. It's 5-6 years of planning. There's been no succession planning for that generation that moved on. And if you look in that Leeds team at the moment, you can see on the pitch now the carry themselves and language. It's not that togetherness and that unity that you talked about earlier. It's a club for me that's lost sight of what its values are.
Because they went to that, they were almost in that relegation zone, then they turned around and beat us in the grand final that year, and then they're back down there again. So it was a very similar team. They didn't lose a lot of players, you know what I mean? So I just, when the most common theme in the press is they're lacking leadership. Now, I just think that's complete bullshit. If you can't find a leader in that Leeds team, then that's bizarre to me. They've got probably well over 1,000 Super League games between them. They've got people that have played State of Origin, probably over 300 first grade games in the NRL there. They have a lot more leaders than most other teams have. What's your thoughts on that?
I'm not as convinced there is, to be fair. I think you talk about the experience and everything there, but some of those players they've got aren't leaders, they're supporting acts. And there is a difference between a leader and somebody that is a bit of a soldier and does as he's told, really. And Leeds have got a lot of soldiers, but not anybody that's going to move them about.
And the thing is, in your team, you need soldiers, don't you? You do need those soldiers, the foot soldiers, but you need a couple of leaders. And I'm a bit with you, Disco. I look at that Leeds team, and there's some really, really good foot soldiers who'll run through brick walls for people. You tell them what to do, and they'll do it. But I'm just not looking at that team and thinking there's a Jamie Peacock in there or there's a Kevin Sinfield in there. And that's a struggle. But you talked about, you know, it's not a 2 month or 3 month accumulation. And I'm always interested, and I don't know what you think on it, but the Kevin Sinfield interview with Brian Kearney, when he said, this has not just happened overnight. This has been rotting from the core for many years. Who do you think that was directed at?
I think it's directed at the hierarchy above him and those that have been in place previously. I think he's right with that. Maybe a little bit harsh tone to take with it, but I think the club, so I can only talk from my experience there. The club was built on good people, hard work ethic, you know, winning culture, good values, but family values as well, and it was built on that. I think it's lost sight of that over the years, and you know, you look at some of the recruitment, for me has been very, very questionable, but they've always kind of relied on the fact that they've had a group of leaders to pull them through, and that team for 10 years didn't need coaching, it just needed managing. You didn't need to show them any technical skills or game plan, or you just needed to manage the group, and that's a real fortunate position for a club to be in, whereas now they look like they need a bit of coaching, a bit of managing, and they need the club basically tearing down and building back up.
So how do you see the values? What's changed there from when you was there?
Well, I'll give you an example. When I signed as an academy player, Bradford was very arrogant how they went about their recruitment of juniors, and Leeds were the humble party and trying to recruit and thing. that's turned full circle. Having been involved at Bradford and knowing some of the recruitment that's gone on at junior level at both, is it's turned full circle. There's a level of arrogance about Leeds and people wanting, and you know, if you're going to be a Leeds player, you've got to want, well, no, Leeds, do you want that player? You've got to show that you need them as much as they need you. And I think that's disappeared. I think there's a level of arrogance there that's
was a little bit of worldly dranos, you need to come, you yeah. come to us, worldly dranos type of thing. And yeah, it's interesting. See, this is what I think, you know, and Warrington have probably took an example out of Leeds book over the years, because the Warrington setup now pretty much do that. They look after all the young kids before they sign. They take them to a game. They show them around the ground. They sit them down at a meal, and they, you know, they have a match, and really, really look forward to saying, you know, like you, to use your words, the family values within the club. You can just see it, and I think that's why, you know, they're having a crop of young kids coming through now. And you know, they employed John Bastion from the Leeds Rhinos, and I think he brought a lot of the Leeds influence with him, and it seems to be paying off for them now.
Yeah, well, he's gone to KR now, but yeah, it did pay off. If you look at what the last 10 years, some of the players that come out of Bradford Bulls Academy is what, Luke Gale, John Bateman, Jake
Luke,
Truman.
Luke Gale came from Leeds Academy.
Did he?
Yeah. He played first grade at Bradford.
Well, yeah.
Bateman, Whitehead, Burgess, Truman's. Yeah, there's plenty.
No,
of
yeah, there. There's some quality players. Okay, just on, do you think Leeds are in a position that potentially they could be out of the Super League, or do you think they'll pull it around?
I think I can't see them getting relegated, because we talked about there is some quality there. They just need somebody within the group to grab it by the scruff of the neck and get back to basics, really, and actually get a grip of the group and make the group a little bit more accountable for each other rather than playing a group of individuals. Start playing for one another, and
yeah, you sort of
the game against Wakefield they showed some glimpses of that.
Yeah, well, they defended their line for them first. What that was, must have been about 5 or 6 sets. That was, they showed a bit of resilience there. And usually they've got their head down, their penalties, they're arguing with the referee. But yeah, I guess they, for me, I think they should turn it around. They should turn it around. But look, you've got London is a hungry team. And they're getting results against people. You only have to look at the weekend. I know it's Saints. Well, they didn't really rest many. They only rested a couple.
I said London would win last week. I predicted it. Saints would do a loss, 3G pitch. But do you know what? If you was to cherry pick the Leeds Rhinos team, everybody had signed for the club, a Super League club. I think what I see at the minute, they're playing like as individuals and not as a team. I think they'd Wakefield, they look a bit more of a togetherness, and you know they looked like they had a game plan and everyone was playing to it. But just over the year, I just don't think they've had that togetherness. You know, like we spoke about when Disco were there, and they just dominated that Super League.
Yeah, well, look, KR, London, Leeds, one of them's going down.
Mm.
Who is it?
Well, I'll be honest, I really don't want London to go down. I'd love Danny Ward keep him up. I think he's doing a great job. I think now KR have got the Tony Smith factor. I'm Tony Smith's biggest fan, me. I think he's great.
I find that hard to believe.
But I just think Tony will keep them up. I think he'll add something there that he'll, you know, galvanise that team, and they'll be all right. And I can't see Leeds going down. But at the moment, my head is telling me that Leeds have a good chance of going down.
I'm not convinced that a, you know, 6 or 7, whatever, what, 10-point win against Wakey, was it?
I don't think it's just those three teams in the mix, though. You look at above the points.
You've got Wigan who's...
There's a few teams flirting down that area of the table. I don't think it's a
few. It depends now on how many wins London, UKR and Leeds can pick up.
London's beat... four of the top five.
Yeah, and this is it now. London, if they play the lower teams and they can start beating those teams, they're in with a great chance. But even though Leeds won against Wakey, they didn't play particularly well. Wakefield were poor.
It was pretty shitty conditions as well. Mm. But look, they nailed them. So what's your thoughts anyway, mate? Who's going down?
I think London's doing exceptional. Wardy, you look at that, developing a team into togetherness, that's what they're doing. You can see how hard they're working for each other, and that 100%. Can take them a long way.
Next Leeds coach, Danny Ward, what do you reckon?
I think it's a bit early for him, but I certainly, you know, you put him in the mix in a year or two's time when he's got that bit more experience, because what a job he's doing down there, he's done exceptionally well. It'd be interesting who they put in there.
Is Fion coaches floating about 40? He's getting tossed about. Maybe KR, the York coach. Mm-hmm. He's doing pretty good things on a low budget there at York. They're sitting outright third, I think.
Well, a few weeks ago we were saying he was going to all KR, weren't we?
Yeah, I think he's pulled back. He's said he's candid, hasn't he?
Tony's there till the end of the year, isn't he? So
yeah.
Well, we'll end part two there. We'll be back after this.
Have you got a future superstar at your amateur club? Get your videos in now to the Bachelor's Mushy Peas Amateur Try of the Week. Just upload your videos to the Rugby AM Facebook page. Each week, the winning try gets a Bachelor's Mushy Pea official ball, and they go into the competition for Try of the Season, where one lucky team will win the chance to train with a Super League team of their choice. Outstanding prize for outstanding talent, thanks to Bachelor's Mushy Peas.
Okay, welcome back to the Giant Woody Show. We're going to have some championship chat.
No. Are we?
Yeah, we'll talk championship.
Take us away then, Woody.
You guys are the experts. You guys are involved in it week to week. But let's start with Bradford and Batley.
Well,
what happened? Come on.
There's a key player coming back for Bradford in the forthcoming weeks.
I've heard he's not going to get
Joe Keys. That is it.
Yeah. Joe
Keys is back, guys.
Seen that? He's back.
I was meant to play Wednesday, but a little half an hour in the reserves or something. But no, my shoulder's just not good. You've had a couple of shoulder reconstructions, haven't you?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, no. What's going on here? Why is this happening? It just feels.
I don't know,
shit.
But my golfing game's gone to shit.
Oh, I won a golf bag as well, a little four ball, and killed it. And I'm never going to get to use the clubs. Right, look, we will talk a bit about championship. For me, this is the tightest championship I've been involved in. Obviously, I only came over in 2015. But when I first came over, there was sort of a four teams at the top and the rest just fighting each other. But now I feel like there's about eight or nine, actually probably about 10 teams that can slip into this five. I think Bradford is seventh. We're 2 points off third. I think if you beat us on the weekend, you would have been 2 points.
Yeah,
off.
We were a bit disappointed because we'd be back in reach for that. And, you know, the team closest to us budget-wise is spending double what we are. And now those above us, you know, we're spending 150 grand a year compared to the boys above us. It's nothing.
Yeah.
So that game was massive for us, and we just didn't perform. We didn't perform with the ball. We controlled some real good elements of the game, you know, possession and low error rate, but I reckon if we were still been playing now, we wouldn't have scored a try.
Yeah, really, still a low scoring game, but I feel like you've got a lot of good shape, but just not getting the points there. I mean, the review we did on your halves are combining, if not, I think probably better than our halves. It's just we were able to come up with the points. What was the mentality coming into the game? Because obviously you win that, you're what 4 points off fourth, and anything can happen.
Yeah, we were really positive and we were really confident, to be fair. You know, we know the Bradford team, it's a good team, but it's a very low-risk team. Don't play very flamboyant rugby. And we knew if we were in the game, we'd have a chance because we were really confident now we were playing with the ball in hand.
Yeah.
But yesterday, we were just really lateral. You know, the halves didn't play square enough. We didn't create an opportunities. As middles were too slow on the floor, which generated no speed. And we were just really under par with the ball in. And defensively, we weren't far off. We conceded a couple of soft tries on the edge where we jumped out of systems, but we controlled a lot of the key elements of the game, whether it be possession, completions and all that. We're very lucky.
You got over a few times and just but were held up.
Yeah.
So and yeah, the point
we challenged for a few kicks, etc. But we were just really lateral with the ball, and as I said there, I was really disappointed with us because we'd actually been clicking a little bit the last few weeks and scored some good tries, and we just didn't deliver at the weekend.
Yeah, you looked good on the video, the preview that we did. What's your thoughts on the 1895, whatever it is.
1895
Cup. How did you as a club approach it compared to a normal league game? And are you buying into it as a club? I personally think the 1895 Cup's ridiculous. I just think it was just thought up. Just 2 weeks before the season started.
Well, we are buying into it because as a club, Batley is a club. You know, I know Bradford with the prestige and history it's got, you know, just been in a quarter final and everything else. They're very, very few and far between for a club of our size and with what we spend. So the 1895 Club Cup is a massive opportunity for us to appear at Wembley that we might never get again. And so we're really going out for it if we're honest, because you know, this 1895 Cup, not much history behind it. What it fought up maybe a couple of weeks, maybe. So it might be gone at the end of the year. So this might be our one chance to get to appear at Wembley. Battley's never appeared at Wembley. They won it in the early 19th century or whatever else it was, but never at Wembley. So for us, it's a chance to make some history. So for a club of our size, and you'll find the club in the lower ends of the Champions League one, will put a bit more priority to what they're probably top teams
do. You know where they won the Challenge Cup then, Battley? Where?
I can't remember. They've won it a couple of times, to be fair.
Yeah. I know I've seen that they've won it, you know, when it goes round.
A bit more, shouldn't that, to be fair. Yeah, but they won the first ever one, I believe.
What do you feel about the 1895, though? There's no prize money in that. That's what baffles me with it. There's no prize money.
Yeah, well, they didn't have a sponsor till a couple of weeks ago. So from what I'm hearing, that might change. It may change. But as we said to our players, whether, you know, I know it's after the main event and everything else, and, you know, there might not be a crowd there, etc., but it doesn't matter, you're playing at Wembley, whether it's in front of six people or 60,000 people, them players might not have a chance ever again to appear there. And the prestige alone to play at Wembley, we're not bothered about the money. We're looking.
They've recently changed it to after the game now as well. It was meant to be before.
Originally at the start, and then it got changed.
But I feel like as Bradford, we were sort of not punished, because if you're gonna do well, you have to play in pretty much all the games. That's how you progress. But I feel like the progression we made in the Challenge Cup has sort of backfired a little bit on us in the respect that we still had to field a sort of like a second Easter period, then it would go into a third Easter period. For Halifax, I think this could make or break their season when it goes back into the normal season games, with the fact that they're going to be playing Sunday, Wednesday again. I just think that's so much rugby, especially for people that are part-time, working every day. I mean, midweek games, we had guys that had to call off sick for work to play in the Wednesday night game. Yeah, we fielded a very young side, well, and we got
We play Sheffield this week, and then we've got Widnes away, York in the 1895 on the Wednesday, and then Toronto home.
Yeah.
Our boys are having to put requests in for leave and all that kind of stuff to get there on time. But, you know, we're buying into it. Yeah. Because for us, it's an opportunity that might not come around again. So we are buying into it.
And do you get that? So you've got that backing from your chairman, even if it could hinder your league position and, you know, affect your prize money at the end of the year?
Yeah. The chairman, you know, he's never walked out Wembley. Battley's never walked out Wembley, so what? Might never get the chance again. So yeah,
and you're in with a real shout as well. I mean, with obviously Toronto and Toulouse not being in it, they're the probably heavyweights of the competition for any other team. But just us and Halifax, we're already out of it. You know, you're in with a real shout to win, and I guess you could push. I can see where your thoughts are pushing to win the game, to get to Wembley. People haven't been there. I just feel like as a club, I think we had 9 games over 3.5 weeks, because we do field a reserves, and I just thought that is just ridiculous. Over 3 different competitions, including the Challenge Cup, in season games, and then a 1985 Cup, I just felt like it was too much rugby, and I don't think they've explained it well enough. No prize money, but no, I wish you all the best. I think my money would be on Battley.
Derek Beaumont, the Lee Centurions owner, sponsored the Cup, anti-ABC, AB Sundex. So if Lee win it, he's basically just going to get a free sponsorship there, isn't he?
Who's left?
Well, we play York away.
Sheffield beat Halifax,
yes. Yeah. So Lee's still in there. It's a tough comp. You know, we play York away. Going to be a very tough game for us midweek with the circumstances. But we're very confident. We went there a while ago and we should have won the game. We gave 16 points away, literally gave them away and handed them to them. So we're confident going, but we know they're a well-coached side and the punching way above the weight at the moment, so we're going to have to be on the button.
Do you approach the game as an Easter weekend where you could just play your best side for every game? So you'll go Sunday, Wednesday,
well,
Sunday?
Well, we've not got a reserve grade in academy or any of that. We've got a squad of 25 players, to which I've got 3 injured at the moment, so I've got 22 players to choose from across... Yeah. Three games in 8 days, so...
Yeah. It's just crazy, isn't it? I mean, obviously, if you come away with them with the 3 wins, you're laughing, but it's just massive to stuff yourself.
Do you not dual reg with anyone this score?
We dual reg with Huddersfield, and to be fair, we've turned down opportunities to take some players on. We've got young Reese Butterworth at the moment because we needed some cover at 9 with Tom Hemingway having to retire because of injury. And I've turned down some real quality, to be fair, because I would rather... go with the boys that They've showed so much commitment to the club.
How do you recruit then if you've no academy? How does that recruitment process, you know, how do you derive your plan if you've not got young kids coming through? You're just cherry picking through the championship and who's available?
Yeah, so we do put a lot of detail into it. We do a lot of analysis on players. So we generally look at three or four players and then we'll stat them over three or four games to see how they're coming up and take a punt on either one. And it does come down to money as well. We have a budget of 150 to 180 grand, which we've got doesn't go a long way if you want quality in your team. Watch a lot of academy rugby to see what kids are falling out of that system. But the jump from academy to championship's massive.
Mm.
You know, the arrogance by Super League to think the dual reg is going to work is ridiculous because there's some... It's a tough competition for young kids to just jump into, so you've got to be careful where they are as well. So it's really tough recruitment because there's not a lot of players down that bottom end to choose from. And as soon as a Halifax come in or a Featherstone or a York who are spending a lot more than us, it's hard for us to compete with.
Yeah, it is underestimated, the championship, by Super League clubs, I think.
Yeah, it's always going to be hard this is why I think there needs to be a reserve grade, but then with a reserve grade, you can't have the championship. That's just how it would work, but you're either going to get the players like myself, say at Castleford, where I'm sort of playing like 10 games a year and I'm sort of in and out of position, I'm competing with two other players that are Super League quality as well, and we're sort of rotating. A top championship side will always be able to buy me, but then I'm replaced in that Super League side by an 18, 19 year old who's not on a lot of money. And it's them clubs that sort of can afford that at the Super League level. Say your Saints, your Warringtons, you know, all them clubs, their players will always be replaced by a player like me. But then the back half of Super League, they'll just replace him with an 18, 19 year old kid that's nowhere near ready for Super League, but they've got him for the budget they've got him on, and a top championship team will just take all them players. It funnels it all down, you know what I mean?
Well, we touched on this last week, and you say 18, 19 year olds were not ready, and we were saying last week, why are these 18, 19 year olds not ready for Super League? Because, you know, last week's State of Origin, there was three 19 year olds playing in the Origin game. So Warrington debuted a 17-year-old on the Saturday. He's the second youngest player to ever play for Warrington. John Duffy, the Lee Centurions coach, is the youngest. Joss Fewless, he had an outstanding game. I was at the match, and I thought he had a great game. You could tell physically he just wasn't quite ready, but he took some monster hits. The Catalans are a big team, and they absolutely smashed him. They threw him everywhere, and he just bounced back up, and he got up. But he probably is, it was a good experience for him. He probably is a little bit way off. But in Australia, you seem to be able to blood these 18, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, and they're ready for first grade.
Yeah, and I think that comes down to the structure and how it's all set up. You know, you've got New South Wales Cup, you've got your Queensland Cup. There's no real... You've also got sort of grassroots pathways that allow players to sort of be placed on a stepping stone all the way up to the top. Do you know what I mean? You've got players here, they're in academy, that are on pay-as-you-play. Now, for how many seasons, I don't know how long you'd put up with that when you can get an apprenticeship with your old man doing bricklaying and earn 15,000, 20,000 a year. Do you know what I mean? At some stage throughout your career, you're going to lose players to the game because they can get better money elsewhere.
No, 100%. I agree. Financial aid, we're not strong enough as a sport financially.
Not everyone can just rely on their parents people, to get them to footy every week. Do you know what I mean?
You know, need to work. We all know as professional rugby players, you've got to make huge sacrifices, and some people are money driven and they're not willing to make those sacrifices. They'd sooner, you know, get the job which offers them more money. But do you think the coaching from a young level now, do you think it's an area that we're lacking? Because you go over to Australia, you see a lot of ex-players involved in professional clubs, and you know, a lot of ex-players involved in the coaching academies and stuff. And do you feel it's an area that we're certainly lacking from a young age?
I think we went backwards early 2000s. You talk about the removal of the reserve grade, which was massive. But along with that, a lot of representative rugby got taken out of the amateur game, and the scholarship, etc. The scholarship for me is a poor system. I think it's damaged the amateur game.
Yeah.
To the point where kids coming out of scholarships don't want to play the game again. You know, you can remember, Woody, when we played 11, 12-year-old, you got to represent your town, whether it be Jewsbury and Batley Schools, every Woolen, you got picked for Yorkshire or Lancashire to schoolboys rugby. that doesn't exist anymore. So kids got an element of elite rugby from 11, 12 years upwards, and the, you know, a taste of it, you know, a different intensity to what they're used to, and that progressed up. That got taken out of the game in the early 2000s, along with the reserve grade. And since then, I think it's gone backwards.
Someone sent me a picture. It was on in a Wigan paper. Wigan Town. It's a black and white one. Wigan Town team it was, under 11s. And I just looked at that picture, brought back so many memories. And it's like I say, it's been taken away now, that Town team, you know, that's been taken away. And basically what I'm trying to say is the winning, the losing has been taken away. I felt from an early age that the winning and the losing and playing for trophies really, you know, galvanised what, you know, sport is all about. What do you feel about the, you know, kids don't win, they don't lose, it's the taking part and all that. I know Jones is not a massive fan of it. To be honest with you, I was all about performance probably 3 or 4 years ago, but now I've sort of gone to the fact that, no, they need to learn these lessons of winning and losing. It breeds a mentality that, you know, win at all costs.
I think at the real young age group, 7, 8, 9, 10 plus, I understand the dilemma, you know, because there's even debate about whether to contact and all that stuff, because the participation numbers are down. And we want to get more kids into rugby league. So I understand debate in that aspect, but at 11, 12 year plus.
But you know, do we bring the right kids into the game? I know we're trying to attract kids, but it's sort of false advertising in a way. The game's a tough game, and we need to.
It's not going to be tackled, but when you turn 14, you're going to get flogged.
Exactly.
And 12 year plus, there needs to be a level of competitiveness.
I feel the quality's dropped as well because of the real changes that have been taken. They've changed the rules at a young age to make the game easier, which I don't feel benefits us in the longer run.
I think if you're going to introduce no tackling, right, to gain the extra participation, I think you lose the participation you gained when you introduce tackling. So it just cancels it out. But I know it sounds like I'm just going, oh, Aussie this, Aussie that, but when I see players coming through the Super League, I just get sick of hearing, oh, this guy's going to be good when he's older. And I'm like, how old is he? He's like 22. I'm like, he should be good. He should have been good 4 years ago. Do you know what I mean? Like, as I said the other week, you got 3 19-year-olds playing State of Origin. You got 17, 18-year-olds playing their second and third year in the NRL. It's like, they should already be good. But that just comes down to funding and grassroots rugby league. And there's no one wanting to do it. There's no ex-players wanting to do it because there's no money in it. Do you know what I mean? I'm sure they'd love to.
You'd be surprised the amount of ex-players that are involved in the amateur game.
Yeah.
There is a lot, but I don't think there's enough.
But you look at the amateur game alone, it's splintered. You know, the Barla and their cooperation with the RFL isn't great, and there's different leagues. There's no unity to it. It's all separately run with separate agendas. And, you know, you talk about the Aussies have got kids coming through. The participation is a hell of a lot higher.
I think we've got more in Queensland than you do in the whole country.
You do, which is massive. So you're going to have kids physically ready at 19, you know, just by law of numbers of it.
Yeah.
We've got to do things a little bit different. You know, we have to. And I think by taking away representative rugby, you know, you talk about winning and losing. But for some kids, we played with kids at Town Rugby or Yorkshire that didn't go on to play pro at different levels, but them representing their county, that level was the highlight of their lives at that time. And it gives an element of success and winning and losing and competing and developing that we don't have in the amateur game at the moment.
Yeah, you know, I always say it when we're comparing Australia and the UK, I think we're comparing two different, completely different animals. You know, you guys have got such a bigger selection and, you know, the finances are there and the structure's completely different. And I, over in England or the UK, wherever, I've no qualms with people getting involved in coaching, even if they haven't played the game. I think where we lack is sort of the amount of education we give coaches, because I'm not saying everybody who coaches rugby needs to have played the game at a high level. I just feel, we was touched on it with Benny Westwood last week, you know, Warrington now are giving coaching seminars to amateur coaches throughout, and I feel that is the area where we lack. I don't think enough coaches or clubs put out, you know, this facility for coaches to come and actually learn, because just doing a 2-day course doing your level 2 rugby badge, it ain't sufficient enough for me.
There needs to be clear curriculum for the kids to develop. You know, I've seen my lads 12-year-old and they've played teams that have got set moves, game plans and all this, but they don't know how to play a 2v1 or a 3v2 on a short side. So there needs to be a curriculum of skills that progresses from 8 to 16-year-old rather than, you know, and you can't criticise the blokes because who else is going to volunteer the times?
Exactly.
That's one thing. This is what I'm saying. I will never criticise anybody who puts their hands up when there's no coach available and said, you know what, I'll do it. Right, well, we'll put you through a level 2 coaching badge. Fair play to that guy because he's given his time, his commitment up. What I do feel sorry for is they push that guy into, or the lady, they push them there to the front line, and then he doesn't get any support. And I feel sorry for some of the coaches, and I'm watching them feel, the poor bugger, you know what I mean? He's just giving his time up, but where's his support? Where's his network?
The NRL currently has a placement program for ex-players to be placed in communities all throughout Australia where, say, rugby league might not be growing as quick as other communities. Rural environments, some in the middle of nowhere. And this is all ex-players. So I think Corey Patterson was doing it before he's come back over here. Rennie Matua does it now. There's must be hundreds of ex-players all up and down the coast of Australia. I just think... You obviously couldn't do that on that scale because obviously you're going to football territory here very easily. But I just think that the Super League as a whole should set up and would benefit from setting up placing ex-players in these areas and sort of running it through there, or just mimicking what the NRL does. Mm-hmm. I know it's always hard, and you say, oh, there's no budget here for that and whatever, but I think something needs to be done in a positive light that can bring positivity back to rugby league and get involvements up.
Well, how do we attract kids now anyway? How do we attract kids to rugby league? How do we make it an attractive sport to kids? Said, you know what, when I'm old, I put my sort of my drive to become a rugby league player down to watching Wigan in the 90s. They won everything. And in Wigan, the Wigan rugby team were like Hollywood movie stars. They used to drive around with the names plastered on the cars and everything, going to Wembley every year. There's always in the papers, you know, they was up for Sportsman of the Year awards, and they were just absolute heroes, and a lot of kids in Wigan wanted to aspire to be like them. So, you know, what is going to drive kids now to have that ambition?
This is a tiny bit off topic, but you know how when you see football players and their flamboyance, their arrogance, they're like dancing after a goal and stuff, NFL players do a very similar thing. They've almost become super celebrity status for the things they do. We don't have that. You're sort of looked upon as a bit of a dickhead if you do that. Do you know what I mean? If you sort of showboat after a try and you did a little... Imagine doing one of them sort of Ronaldo bullshit moves he pulls off. You sort of just get touted as a bit of a dick, you know what I mean? People sort of have a crack at you. But, like, why is that? Why are we so suddenly jumping on anyone that's trying to be a little bit different? Like, you've seen NFL players, some of the stuff they do carrying on in the end zone. Football players do it, you know, basketball players do it. It's like, but these, if I said, oh, who's LeBron James? Everyone knows who LeBron James is. If I say, who's Cristiano Ronaldo? Everyone knows who that is, right? If I say, who's Luke Gayle? Not everyone is going to know who that is. And why is that? How do we get that ultimate player, that top tier player to become a superstar?
The problem you've got with the UK, it's a northern sport with working class backgrounds, where if anybody is flashy or thing, you soon clip down the ear and jump down. So it's a cultural thing as much as anything else. But yeah, I think what Woody's talking about is that the players were seen, they were in the community, seen around the town. And, you know, some clubs are doing great stuff with the foundations and they're getting the badge and the club out there. But, you know, going back to our time, and it's easy to preach, you sound like an old footy doddy, don't you, at the end of it, but you were, part of your apprenticeship was you got designated schools and you had to go coaching and you learnt your badges, and the academy boys were out there and they got to see players, you know, you got to see and interact with who your heroes were. And, you know, some clubs are doing a great job of that, but is it as good across the whole of Super League as what it should be? It's up for debate.
Warrington is doing a very good job.
Yeah, Warrington, I mean, but to go back, where I'm talking about rugby league players being superstars, even to this day now, and they haven't played rugby for, what, over 20 years, the most famous rugby league players in this country now, if you was to ask anybody and you down south, up north, Ellie Hanley, Sean Edwards, Martin Afire, and they ain't played the game for 20 years. So what's happening? Why are people not saying Sam Tompkins, you know, John Bateman, you know, these types of players? Why are we not now publicising our rugby league players as superstars?
Mm, yeah, that's the exact point that I'm trying to bring up as well. I think, as you said, that's a good point as well. Working class background, everyone sort of thinks, oh, we don't do that.
It'd be interesting to see what the RFL department doing. So from a press point of view, you know, reporters, all papers are looking for an easy job. They don't want to be out getting stories and looking for stuff. The RFL should be each week sending a ready pre-written stories to the national press. So all they have to do is look and think. I'm not sure that's happening. Mm. You know, you look, London, biggest upset they've had in years against St. Helens, none of it in any local national press. Yeah. You can't find it anywhere. But is the RFL, is the press department, so they're sending these pre-prep ready stories out there, and they should be firing them out, tens and tens of them each week for the national press and local press just to pick up and publish. Yeah. I'm not sure that's happening.
There's really not much positive when you open a rugby league paper, is there? I mean, it's mainly negative. The go-to story is the negative story for some reason, whereas I think
that's
it's in
society as well, that everything in the newspaper is negative. But I mean, it is so frustrating when you play the game and you know, Disco just said it there, is, you know, why are these, you know, articles and not handed out to newspapers, and why we're not getting more exposure? It doesn't seem like rocket science, does it, to be able to do what you've just suggested? And it just gets frustrating. It just drives me wild. I can't get it. Maybe I'm not intelligent enough to see it, that, you know, there's more to it than just sending an article out and getting us in the paper. But
the championship game on the weekend was labelled Championship League Rugby on Sky Sports, and Warrington Catalans game was labelled Super Rugby Union. That's what it was labelled. And so, like, our own TV broadcasters can't even get it right.
It does seem, though, when there's a mess up or a cock up with Sky or something else, it always involves
rugby. On live TV. It's
Well, everyone's done that. But do you know, even to the point where when I was watching Leeds and Wakefield, I was watching it and there was just rain all over the lens, and I thought, hang on a minute, this won't happen in football. Why does it happen in rugby league?
You go on all day. Have you seen a game at every single stadium? They decide to broadcast the way there is no one else in the other side stand. But there is a fair few people there. Just put the camera on the other side.
I think this is where it's easy to get disillusioned with a game like a Tots, but the game itself as a product's amazing.
Yeah.
It's a great product, and
yeah,
just it's got so much going for it. If people actually got on board, sat around a table, instead of fighting each other and pulling different directions, and actually put a plan in place that was for the better of the whole game rather than it just being for Super League or just for Championship or RFL, we'd make progress. But until we stop that, those politics, this product that is so good is just going to be for us and nobody else.
It's an each to your own thing, isn't it, at the moment?
I think that's why a lot of ex-professional players like going to the roots of where it all started, because that is what you believe is rugby league, you know, the amateur game, the volunteers, the way everybody pulls together, and you sometimes lose sight of that when you're involved in professional sport.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. Right, listen, we want to thank Disco for coming on, mate. Absolute pleasure. All the best to Batley Bulldogs this year in the season and in the 1895 Cup. I hope you do it. Hope the Bulldogs run out at Wembley and kick their ass. Woody?
See you later.
This is a Rugby AM production.